Good day, listeners. This is your host, Michael Martins, with the Martins Critical Review, broadcasting this morning from another hazy and warm day here in West Kelowna, British Columbia. In today's program, we continue our series on the conservation of humanity, exploring the Wuhan flu COVID-19 pandemic, examining censorship and persecution of medical professionals to perpetuate the faulty and baseless claims supporting the mainstream narrative. Joining us today is Dr. Francis Christian, MD. Dr. Christian has been a surgeon for more than 20 years and began working in Saskatoon in 2007. He is a practicing surgeon and has held the position of clinical professor of general surgery at the University of Saskatchewan. He was appointed director of the Surgical Humanities Program and director of quality and patient safety in 2018 and co-founded the Surgical Humanities Program. Dr. Christian is also the editor of the Journal of Surgical Humanities. He recently made headlines for raising the alarm and questioning the safety and efficacy of the experimental mRNA vaccines and whether the present COVID-19 situation presented an adequate emergency to warrant the deployment of these experimental products. This was met with a draconian response from the Provincial Health and University of Saskatchewan officials. Dr. Christian, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for your time today. It's a real honor to be able to speak with you.
Happy to be here, Michael.
Fantastic. So before we delve into the details of the present situation, perhaps you could share some of your background with the listeners and your motivations for practicing medicine.
Well, the reason most of us became physicians is so that we can carry out the healing mandate, right? So the healing and helping humanity is the mandate that has been passed on from generation to generation. And that hasn't really changed. That mandate to heal, to help, and not to harm. And so that was more or less the reason most of us became physicians. As you pointed out, Michael, I did start the quality improvement and patient safety unit in the Department of Surgery in Saskatoon, in Saskatchewan here. I'd also started the National Surgical Quality Improvement Program, the NISQIP program for the Department of Surgery here. I had founded the Surgical Quality and Safety Committee, which I co-chaired. And together with our university computer department, I developed an app, which is now available on the Apple Store and Google Play. It's called the M&M app, or the Morbidity and Mortality app. And it is ironically now being used across the province of Saskatchewan. As you pointed out, Michael, I co-founded the Surgical Humanities Program. I'm a poet as well as a surgeon. I'm the editor of the Journal of the Surgical Humanities, which I founded. And as a matter of fact, the fall 2020 issue of the Journal of the Surgical Humanities is actually devoted to COVID-19, to the pandemic, including my editorial. And if your listeners, viewers, go to the Department of Surgery Saskatchewan website, they can find copies of my journal there, which they can read. Now, as you just pointed out, on the 23rd of June, I was called into what was termed a WebEx meeting with the dean, the chief medical officer, and the interim head of the department. I was stripped of my university faculty position, suspended from it, and fired from my roles as director of QI and patient safety and director of the Surgical Humanities Program. My offense or crime was supposedly asking for informed consent from parents and children. In the rollout of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine to our children in Saskatchewan. Now, some of your listeners and viewers might have already heard about my suspension and firing, because the recording of that meeting with the dean, the chief medical officer, and the interim head of the department has been heard in many places around the world. And that recording is on the JCCF website. The JCCF is the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms. It's a group of very dedicated lawyers, many of whom left lucrative jobs because they felt these fundamental freedoms are worth fighting for. They represent me. And Canadians don't know much about the JCCF, but I would encourage Canadians to go to their website, jccf.ca, and find out more.
Sure. So before we go any further, the surgical humanities, that's a new term that I haven't heard before. Could you help us out and with the definition or an explanation of that?
The science of being a physician, okay, the education in the methods of science is what our educational institutions, universities, medical schools concentrate on, right? Rightly so. It is that concentration on science that has made life for humanity immeasurably better over the last century than it was before. But we know that that is not enough. We need to hear the human story, its struggles, its joys, its tears, its fears. The human story is what the humanities is, and it includes things like poetry, literature, art, music, and sculpture, philosophy, medical history. Because without an engagement with the humanities, you can make a very good scientist, arguably, because even that is open to doubt. I mean, this pandemic has shown that if you don't have humanity, if you don't have a very good grounding in the human story, you really cannot be a good physician or scientist. But you certainly cannot be a good physician if you don't know the human story. And the human story is what comprises, in a very condensed explanation that I can offer, the human story is what comprises the humanities, and the surgical humanities is within this umbrella of the medical humanities, and the surgeon has a particular story to tell the world. So we have that journal, we have a Surgical Humanities Day, where we have a grand rounds where we discuss surgical history or philosophy. We 3 years ago we had our Indigenous friends and partners come and tell us about their experiences in the residential schools. We have poets, authors come and speak to us. Then the evening, we have a orchestra that is comprised of our physicians and surgeons, and we have an evening of fine music. The whole day is occupied by an exhibition of art. So, physicians, medical students, residents, nurses, they are welcome to come and exhibit their art and their creations, and that's the Surgical Humanities Day. And we have a few more programs, and this is in an encapsulated explanation what we do in surgical humanities.
Okay, so really the bridge between the pure science of being a physician and the human experience.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay,
And we
okay.
emphasize, and I made this very important right from the time I founded the department, that it's not enough to just talk about the humanities. We need to engage with it. So that's why we have an exhibition of art, actual creative work from our physicians, medical personnel, nurses being exhibited, or the journal where we encourage physicians to write in the journal, or non-physicians to write about medical things, or the the orchestra, which is comprised of physicians, residents, surgeons. An engagement is important, not just reading about it.
Yes. And then, Dr. Christian, where were you originally educated?
I moved to Canada from the UK. I did my fellowship there from the Royal College of Surgeons of Edinburgh. And after I came here, I also acquired the Canadian Fellowship, which is the Fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons of Canada. And I've been in Saskatoon since 2007.
Okay, great. And then if we look at, and you sort of touched on these fundamental tenets of medicine, the Hippocratic Oath, and now we have also informed consent. And I think these are some very, very important aspects that seem to be missing in this present dialogue with regards to the COVID-19 situation. Could you summarize for the listeners what these are and why they're so important?
Yes, I'd be happy to. On the 17th of June, 1 week before my suspension and firing, I held a press conference. It was a press conference where only physicians spoke. We didn't take questions, but astonishingly and miraculously, the mainstream media were there. CTV was there and Global News was also there. I started off by saying that I do not represent any group, and I did not represent my health authority. I did not represent the University of Saskatchewan. That I, as a surgeon and a human being, a practicing surgeon, I was addressing directly the parents and their children. I pointed out in the press conference that, in fact, I'm a very pro-vaccine physician. And I was only aware of, I was only too aware of the great scourges of mankind, you know, including smallpox that have been eliminated or made innocuous by vaccination. I told the press and the audience that I was also pro-vaccine for my own family, including myself. I told the press at the press conference that during the COVID-19 pandemic, I had continued to work actually looking after patients in my clinic and in my operating rooms. And then I addressed directly the parents and their children. And I pointed out that we as parents, grandparents, we want the best for our kids. And I too want the best. And that there was a sacrosanct principle in medicine before any kind of drug or treatment or intervention is administered to the public. It is the principle of informed consent. Which is what you were referring to, Michael. This principle is actually very simple, yet has truth, it has science, and it has humanity at its heart. And very simply, the person by whom the drug, vaccine, or intervention is administered must always, always make the patient or the person, or the child in this case, fully aware of the risks of the medical intervention or vaccine, the benefits of the vaccine, and if any alternatives exist to the vaccine, and that this should apply particularly to a new vaccine that has never before been tried in humans. So I pointed out then, Michael, that the new mRNA vaccine, which was at that time and still is, being administered at warp speed to children as young as 12 and 13, was not fulfilling the criteria for informed consent. I said parents must give informed consent to this new vaccine. They must know the risks of the vaccine, the benefits of the vaccine, any alternatives to the vaccine. I pointed out that I hadn't met, and I still haven't met, a single child or parent who have been adequately informed, who then understand the risks of the vaccine or its benefits. And then I listed a few very basic points, which it's been a month since that press conference. Those have not changed because the science is absolutely solid I pointed out that the mRNA vaccine is a new experimental vaccine design and has never been used in humans before. I pointed out that the mRNA vaccine had not and still is not fully authorized by either Health Canada or by the CDC in the USA, or in most nations around the world, actually. In Canada, they're under what is called interim use authorization. How many Canadians know that? In the USA, the CDC has them under emergency use authorization, and full vaccine approval takes several years and multiple safety considerations, and this had not, still has not, happened with the mRNA vaccines. The other thing I pointed out is that in order to qualify for emergency use authorization, there must be an emergency, right? I mean, that's pretty basic. For the elderly population, for the vulnerable, for healthcare workers, arguably, there is, of course, an emergency. Several thousand people in Canada have died of COVID-19, but the mean age of those who have died is 83.8. There is therefore a strong case, you might say, Michael, for vaccinating the elderly, the vulnerable, healthcare workers. But COVID-19 does not pose a threat to our kids. The risk of them, that is our kids, dying from COVID is less than 0.003%. And this is even less than the risk of them dying of the flu. There was no emergency in children, and so there was no need for emergency use authorization of a vaccine in children. I pointed out that parents and children must know that children do not readily transmit the COVID virus to adults. This has been shown in multiple studies. And in many countries, actually, teachers had significantly lower rates of COVID-19 than the general population. And then I pointed out that the mRNA vaccines have been associated with several thousand deaths in the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, or the VAERS system, in the United States. Now, at that time, when I gave the press conference, there were almost 6,000 deaths. That has doubled almost. I think it is 11,000 and counting now. And these are associations, are not verified yet as causation from the vaccine, but most of them have occurred very soon after the vaccine. And in any other drug or vaccine program, they would have been sufficient to stop the whole program, just stop it. A pause, a kind of a regrouping, and suddenly a big signal to not give it to our kids. So that is again something that the parents and children should understand as part of informed consent. They should also understand, and this was a month ago, it's still true, the mRNA vaccine was already causing serious medical problems for kids all over the world. There was a, and still is, a real and significantly increased risk of a condition called myocarditis, or inflammation of the heart, which can then result in some kids in a condition called dilated cardiomyopathy, or, you know, in the worst case scenarios, they can go into cardiac failure. Some children can die of myocarditis as a complication of the vaccine. So all these were sufficient to make the German Vaccine Agency, the Swedish National Vaccine Agency, and lately also officially now, the UK Vaccine Agency are advising their health authorities not to give the vaccine to healthy kids. So I posed the question at the press conference, when will Health Canada act? Since the principle of avoiding harm was paramount. And then I pointed out too that the benefit of the vaccine in the trials was only what we call relative risk, but the absolute risk reduction was less than 2%. And small trials like the Pfizer trials cannot detect real risk and cannot really address the medium and long-term side effects, which we don't know anything about. And finally, I pointed out that there was effective early treatment, ivermectin and other agents, both for kids and the adults. And this common, cheap, and very safe drug was being blocked in many Western countries. So that I thought was informed consent at its minimum and what it should look like. I urged the authorities then to call a pause to the vaccine program for our kids, for our kids. And I pointed out that informed consent was not being given to parents and children or taken from them in Saskatchewan for mRNA vaccine for our kids. And then, you know, there is something called the Nuremberg Code, which was built on informed consent. And the Nuremberg Code was built after the horrific atrocity of, Nazi Germany committed in the concentration camps, where they experimented on the inmates of those concentration camps, medical experiments without informed consent. And I pointed out that it's possible that around the world, the Nuremberg Code is being violated, and our authorities must wake up to this fact. And that's all I said. This is not controversial. I mean, medical professionals listening to this, as well as the public, will realize that what I just said is actually not controversial at all. It is what generations of physicians have been telling their patients. It's what we call informed consent. In other words, any intervention, any vaccine, the patient must know the risks, the benefits, and any alternatives.
Yes, and clearly a 12-year-old child has no ability to provide a medical professional with informed consent because they cannot reason. Their reasoning and their intellectual ability doesn't allow them to grasp such complicated concepts. And so to lower this age of consent down to 12 for this experimental product is criminal. I mean, it's simply, we don't allow 12-year-old children to drive or to fly a plane. For the
Or
same
to drink
reason.
alcohol.
Exactly. So why would we allow them to allow themselves or to give a medical procedure permission to be administered to themselves?
Absolutely.
And so what then was the response from the University of Saskatchewan
So
and the health authority?
this was supposedly the reason I was suspended and fired, because I asked for informed consent. And that recording of that meeting with the people who suspended and fired me is available through the JCCF website, jccf.ca, and you can listen to it. It's dystopian.
Yes, and
It's
now
just
I have listened to it, and it I have to commend you that you handled yourself very well. You were very diplomatic. I was utterly shocked by the content and the delivery. I mean, it was more of a browbeating, that you would give to a child who had, done something bad, as opposed to a medical professional who was, advocating for the health of his patients and for
asking informed
and
consent.
for. Yeah, simple. And in particular, Dr. Susan Shaw, who I'm not sure what her position is, but she was very belittling, very condescending, and actually went on to suggest that you might need some help because you'd kind of lost your mind and needed some clinical advisement. And my question when I and you there was some rebuttal, from your side to say, haven't you seen the data? And they just dismiss it outright. And my question is, where are they obtaining their guidance and the scientific basis for their arguments?
Well, this is actually an old playbook. I mean, if you dissent from the official narrative, you can be persecuted if you are living under some sort of a dystopian tyranny. As a matter of fact, I've pointed out, including briefly in that recording, that this is the playbook of the Soviet Union. And it's Canadians have forgotten what the Soviet Union and communism again under the Soviet Union was like. But remember, it was only about 30 years ago that the Soviet Union started collapsing. Before that, the tyranny held sway for more than 70 years. Okay. And the targeting of intellectuals, in academia, the targeting of professionals was done routinely in the Soviet Union. Now, I pointed out in that recording that I didn't accuse those in the tribunal against me of being Soviet or Nazi agents or people, but the transcripts of how they handled, these tribunals handled dissent in the scientific community is actually available for historians to read. And I have studied the Soviet Union in considerable depth. I initially became interested in this because of the severe persecution that people just possessing a Bible were undergoing. If you were caught with a Bible or giving out a Bible, you could be sent to the gulag or to a psychiatric hospital or so on. So right from when I was a teenager, I've studied Soviet history and the methods of authoritarian control. And I don't know if your listeners, viewers know of a term, which I think maybe in Wikipedia as well. It's called Lysenkoism. It's spelled Lysenkoism. Lysenkoism.
Yes, and, yes.
Yes. And Lysenko was a scientist in the Soviet Union who believed in one particular way of doing agriculture. Okay. So he was, he called himself a geneticist. And he started this system of persecution of everybody who held anything but what they call the only correct theory. In fact, in 1948, there was a carefully stage managed, what they called a scientific debate between the two schools of the then Lenin Academy of Agricultural Sciences. And the debate was terminated by the Central Communist Committee saying that they had approved Lysenko's position paper, and Lysenkoism would henceforth be taught as, quote unquote, the only correct theory. If you go into the history books, you will realize that in the subsequent scramble, I guess, for survival, Soviet geneticists, biologists were forced to denounce each other and any work that contradicted Lysenko's theories. So there was this very successful attempt by the Soviet authorities to divide the scientific community and then persecute those who didn't agree with the official narrative. And more or less that is what was taking place. And some of the transcripts even are very similar to some of the things that were said in that meeting with me, you know, things like, you know, Francis, you're an intelligent man, but you're using your intelligence in the wrong way. You're associating with the wrong people.
Yes, yes. And let me just jump in here. It's very interesting that you say, you know, make the statement that this is right from the KGB playbook. I had a wonderful conversation with a Ukrainian lady that grew up under the Soviet boots, who emigrated to Canada and has raised her family here. And we had a great conversation after I had interviewed Artur Pilowski, the pastor who was taken down by the SWAT team in Calgary. Yeah. And she said to me, you know, nothing that is happening here today is new. This is all directly from the KGB playbook. There, you know, everything that I see, I've seen before, and I wish Canadians would wake up to see what is going on. And for some reason, they're all sitting there, you know, digesting the Communist Broadcasting Corporation's news feed and believing lockstep what they're telling us. And, you know, as you suggest, I think we have come into some form of modern day, dystopian Lysenkoism, where if you deviate from the accepted or the state's narrative, you're persecuted and ridiculed. And, you know, clearly you're not, you haven't lost your faculties. You haven't said anything, salacious or sensational. You've stuck with the facts. You're not advocating for your own self-aggrandizement. You're advocating for patient safety and the safety of the children.
And a very simple principle, the principle of informed consent. That's it.
Yes. Yes. So where did your interest in studying the Soviet regime, you know, you mentioned that you from a very early teenager there, it just was this something that interested you, or where did that come from?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the fact is, the Soviet Union was persecuting people just for reading the Bible, okay? And as a Christian, I became very interested in that, because you know, the Bible is so basic to our faith and to the revelation of God in Christ. So then I realized they were persecuting those who read the Quran, or those who read the Jewish Bible, or any religious literature at all. And the fact is, atheism was a state construct and a state principle. Anybody who deviated from that would be viciously persecuted, as your Ukrainian friend who immigrated from the Soviet Union would know. And so from that interest in the persecution of Christians, I read a book which is still available. It's called Tortured for Christ, where Richard Wurmbrand was held in prison and under torture just because he was telling people about Jesus. And that's it. That was his supposed crime. Anyway, so the control of media, which is happening now by government, is again a very well-known Soviet tactic. Okay. So the fact is, mainstream media is now essentially an arm of government. And this happened in the Soviet Union too. Actually, you have to go back to 1917. And I'm just going to pull it up here, and I'm just going to read, if I may,
Please.
from the Council of People's Commissars decree on the press. This was Lenin himself who actually gave this speech. It is from November 9th of 1917, and I'll just read a couple of important points from that decree on the press. It says, quote, "Publications can be proscribed temporarily or permanently only by decision of the Council of People's Commissars." So if you translate that into today's press and media, it'll be only by the decision of the government, the public health agencies, YouTube, Twitter, and the mainstream media, CBC, CTV, and so on, that they can proscribe temporarily or permanently any kind of information. The next point reads, I quote, "The present ordinance is of a temporary nature and will be repealed by a special decree as soon as normal conditions of social life set in." We hear this all the time, that these emergency rules now are just a temporary thing. You know, we have to get control of this virus and then everything will go back to normal. That didn't happen, Michael, in the Soviet Union. It didn't happen for 70 long years.
Yes,
Now,
yes.
you know, the other thing, the other bizarre similarity between what was happening in the Soviet Union and now is, you know, there is a, your Ukrainian friend would know that, who came from the Soviet Union. There was one particular encyclopedia. They didn't read, or they were not allowed to read, any Western encyclopedia. So it was called a Great Soviet Encyclopedia. And what it said was that about Soviet censorship was that it had, quote, "It was only aimed at protecting the interests of the working class." So again, this the government now justifies all the censorship because they say this is this the what is what we're doing is we're protecting the public from misinformation and disinformation. As a matter of fact, it was last May that I started questioning the official narrative because they were using these same words. They were using these same tactics from the Soviet Union. You know, up to the end of April, beginning of May, I actually was supporting the official narrative. I said, you know, let's see, this is a new virus. I didn't agree with some of the ways in which the lockdowns were being implemented, but I thought, you know, let's give the government, the public health guys, a bit of rope. Then they started censoring. And they were not censoring just anybody. They were censoring people of world renown, people we already knew about. Martin Kulldor for, you know, the great Harvard-based epidemiologist, mathematician, statistician, whose software, ironically, is being used by epidemiologists in the field even today. He was being censored. Jay Bhattacharya of Stanford was being censored. Sunitra Gupta of Oxford was being censored. The FLCCC, which was built up of world-renowned intensive care specialists, the second most published ever intensive care specialist in the world, a guy called Paul Marrick, a guy called Pierre Corey, whose point-of-care ultrasound book is still used. It's used even in our hospitals here. So these guys were all being censored. What they were saying was labeled misinformation or disinformation. And I thought, this is straight out of the Soviet playbook. And then I started being skeptical. And essentially, skepticism is part of science. We have to question the official narrative in order for science to progress. I mean, we all know, as physicians, as scientists, that the scientific method itself now is under unprecedented assault in modern times. Unprecedented because it's on a global scale. The Soviet Union, yes, it ruled and occupied half the world, but now it's on a global scale. And we know that the scientific method, which has been responsible for so much human progress and the relief of human suffering, is itself being subjected to daily abuse. But these totalitarian authorities acting together with a compliant press and major, you know, internet platforms. The latter, of course, are acting as arms of government, arms of big pharma, and arms of big business. So it's a different kind of tyranny, but it's very similar, disturbingly similar to the Soviet tyranny.
Yes, just on a larger scale. And of course, yep. the second point there that you raised from Lenin's speech there from 1917 about the temporary measures, of course, we have something similar going on in Canada right now, which very few people are aware of, which is the Motion 118, which suspended federal elections until the end of the pandemic, which shockingly was voted 327-1. Now, that to me is an absurd situation where we have a completely nebulous target, which, you know, seemingly has been kicked down the road continuously since last March. So when is the pandemic going to be over, and when may we see an election in this country? And certainly if I'm at the head of state, like Mr. Dressup is, why on earth would I ever call an election? I have firm grip on power for as long as I choose to perpetuate this story.
Yeah, I mean, I have a, you know, somewhat, I guess, cynical view of Canadian politics. Because
I don't blame parties, you.
I realized over the last very, you know, just a few years that, and especially during this pandemic, that Canadians really don't have a choice. I feel sorry for ourselves, actually, because all parties are now corporate interests. They don't differ very much in what they say. They pretend that they differ, but actually they're all saying the same thing and speaking from the same party line. I do agree with you. I'm not sure that an election would change things. I don't know whether a conservative government would do anything different, because don't forget, the conservative government, conservative party is also acting like the Soviet Union. It doesn't like dissent. It expels people who, you know, disagree with it. It votes with the government almost all the time about this pandemic. So I don't know. I mean, hopefully, you know, there will be people with some spine to present a different vision for Canadians. I don't see that now, though.
No, certainly not. I mean, there's some Maxime Bernier seems to be more of a people's champion, but unfortunately, I'm not sure that his party really has a chance to amass enough seats to even become the opposition. So, you know, that may be a, a work in progress. And of course, if there's no election called, there's no opportunity for anyone to cast a vote in any case.
Very true, very true.
So how do you feel that we arrived at this situation? I mean, has this been a steady trend toward this direction, or is this an abrupt change which has been dictated by some external source from above?
That is a very good question because, in the progress of tyranny, our freedoms are taken away not in one fell sweep, okay? And that's the same thing that happened in the Soviet Union too. Little by little, we lose our freedoms. And then by the time we wake up, it is often too late. And that's why I have been asking Canadians generally, and also my professional colleagues in medicine, to listen to the voice of conscience, the voice of science, examine the data for themselves. And among my colleagues, I just want to appeal to you directly. If there is a voice of conscience that is telling you that you should not be following the official narrative, that you should be questioning the official narrative, do it now and do it openly, because later may be too late.
Yes, and are we seeing an unprecedented situation with these medical colleges, both physician colleges as well as the nurses colleges, where they're censoring and controlling what their medical professionals under them are able to say or speak?
Yes, and that's again part of the Soviet playbook. I mean, these are all co-opted arms of government now. And one of the really disturbing things is they believe that this is in the public interest. Okay, so C.S. Lewis said that the more dangerous tyrant is the one who believes in his tyranny in the public interest. The one who is openly tyrannical and is it knows that what he's doing is evil and tyrannical is less dangerous, because you know exactly their agenda. But most of the public, except you and me, and unfortunately now a minority of Canadians still, I hope that'll become a majority very soon. Most people believe that the tyranny is doing something for their good, as the Soviet encyclopedia puts it. It's for the people, for, you know, the public. And that sort of tyranny is much more dangerous, really.
Yeah, or as the Nazis said, für eure Sicherheit, right? For your safety. I mean, that's really...
Right, exactly. You know, that's a good way of putting it. Yes. I've studied the Nazi system less well, but the parallels are there. And as a matter of fact, the Nazis also went after academia. Academics, including the great Einstein, was forced to flee because they were not towing the party line.
Well, we've seen that with every totalitarian regime. I mean, Mao and the rest of the Asian communists, same happened in Cuba. I mean, you cannot have an educated class that is able to reason and think critically and dispel or attempt to dispel the narrative. I mean, that's simply not conducive to taking over and taking charge.
And human beings tend to forget uncomfortable facts in history, right? So it may be that it is a built-in mechanism in our memory that we tend to believe the best in authorities. So, for example, most people believe all governments, especially in the West, but all over the world, they have the interests of the people at heart. Okay, especially in an emergency like this, or a supposed emergency or COVID pandemic, people think, oh, the government is doing its best. It's doing it all for our sake. But, you know, if you look at the 20th century, who has killed the maximum number of people? Yes. It's not individuals, it's governments. Yeah. Mao has killed the Mao Communist Party in China has killed, you know, anything from 30 to 100 million people, okay? Under the Soviets, at least 20 to 25 million people were killed, okay? Under the Nazis, if you take in the toll of the horrible atrocities that are committed in the Holocaust on Jewish people, on homosexuals, on gypsies, on the Poles, the 21 million Russians who were killed, and so on. Governments have been responsible for much more atrocities than individual people. And you have to question governments. You can't just accept everything that the government tells you.
And certainly, my father's a reasonable man, and generally intelligent in most aspects of how he interacts with the world. But he seems to have this notion that the government is there as his friend to help out, and that why would they do something that wasn't for our benefit? And I think that older generation maybe grew up in a slightly different time where perhaps the government was more benevolent in North America, where they were administering the economy and the country for the betterment of the people. But I don't think you can say that anymore. That's certainly not simply isn't true anymore.
Well, it's very interesting that you say that. But many of the 60s generation, or what has been also called the hippie generation, are also skeptical of government. Not all. Many of that generation then embraced the materialistic lifestyle, and just forgot about some of those back-to-earth principles and so on. But those have remained true to some of those ideals also question the present narrative. And it's just not, it's not confined to you and me or to people of faith from different backgrounds. It's also these, the libertarians, the people on the left, and the hippie generation who have stayed true to that vision of questioning government narratives. Because the other people have forgotten, for example, the great lie that was Vietnam, and the it spawned a generation of people questioning the government, and the
Yes.
government lied to people in the 1960s massively. The government invented battles which never existed in order to get kids to go and fight in Vietnam. The rich kids never went there. But the poor kids, white, black, and brown, were being slaughtered on those Vietnamese battlefields. And that, of course, led to the anti-war movement and so on. But that was a big, gigantic lie that was sold to the Western public. And so, communism had to be opposed, but the relentless bombing of civilians in Vietnam was also a war crime, and that then led to activists. Many of them were from that 60s generation, who started questioning some of the government narratives, and so there is unfortunately a minority, but hopefully a growing minority, and soon to become a majority. We have to live in hope.
Yes. And so, in terms of the what is unfortunately now the majority that seem to be with blind faith following what the public health authorities have decreed, they seem, that they'll now obey whatever ridiculous edicts or requirement that are handed down. And how many of these booster shots are people willing to accept? How many reported deaths or injuries will they continue to ignore? And what is it going to take for people of that unquestioning majority to wake up to the reality of what's going on in front of them?
And that's a very good question. I've concentrated on informed consent, on medical ethics, on the pledge that we have taken to always follow evidence-based medicine for our patients. And I want patients and the public to do their own research as well, because it's a little easier nowadays with the internet. Don't believe the government's version of information, disinformation, and misinformation. Do your own reading. There is misinformation out there. There is disinformation. But it's not the government's job to point out what is misinformation and disinformation. The governments are not always reliable. I hope my little discussion with you, Michael, has shown that governments cannot always be trusted. And so you have to do your own research. mainstream media is now an arm of government, so when they speak, they don't do critical investigative journalism. You were talking about your father, and your father was brought up in a generation which at least did investigative journalism. It was, I think it was possible for them to do that because the Soviet Union was held up as this big opposite idea to the liberty and freedoms of the West. Now that opposite idea is gone, we are becoming what the Soviet Union was. So, that's kind of a disturbing but easy way of explaining it.
Sure. And of course, I guess there's two points to that. One, yes, information's available on the internet readily. I mean, if you look at the VAERS system in the United States, you see that we're almost at 11,000 deaths. In the EU, we're exceeding 17,000. And between those two geographic centers, we're almost at 2 million injuries. So, people are free to see that information. But then, of course, this week we also had the White House admitting that they're colluding with big tech or the big social media platforms to attempt to limit what they are calling, mis or disinformation, and have targeted, I think there's 12 or 16 doctors who are, similar to yourself, who are not espousing crazy conspiracy theories. They're merely, looking at evidence-based medicine and informed consent. And somehow these have now become, the most wanted members of society for their preaching their disinformation.
Yeah, I mean, again, you have to remember that free speech was a value for which people have died, okay? And I'm not talking just about, some people at least will know about how, people like Wycliffe and so on, the early translators of the Bible into English, they were, just because they wanted people to read the Bible, they were burned at the stake, okay? They were executed, they were persecuted, they were imprisoned. So those are some of the well-known examples. But the examples of people who have given their lives for free speech go right down to the present time, okay? And it's not something we should give up easily. Remember, people have died for free speech. It's not one of those things which people talk about free speech like it's a fundamental right. It is a very much a fundamental right, but it's also a right won in blood. People have actually given their lives so that they can
Yes.
speak freely. And if the White House is going after things that they don't agree with, again, remember, the governments can't be trusted. Governments have also, remember, they have sanctioned things like giving venereal disease to black people in order to test certain treatments on them. So, I mean, you can look it up. I think it's called the is you might know the name of it. It's called the Tuskegee experiments. That is
Yes, I've
sanctioned.
yeah, I've seen
That's
them, yes.
sanctioned by the government, and I believe in the 1930s or 40s in America. So governments, I think there are some good people in government, but government as a whole, as a body, cannot be trusted to tell the truth. Our democracies are founded on holding governments to account. Okay,
Yes.
it's not it's the governments are not absolute rulers. They work for the people. They're servants of the people. Public servants. I mean, who does anybody in the public health people, the colleges, the premiers, the prime minister of this country, of other Western nations, how often do they use that term? We are your servants. We are public servants. But modern democracies are founded on that idea that our rulers are actually serving us. They're not serving Big Pharma or a particular agenda, or they shouldn't be.
And unfortunately, I think there's a, and I've made this point on the program several times, where it was 70 years ago or so, and there was a bunch of young men and boys that stormed the beaches of Normandy with an incredible act of bravery and courage. And the horrors that they experienced somehow have been forgotten. And whether that was just or unjust or propped up by financiers and the rest of it, I mean, there was a battle of freedom, and their men sacrificed their lives and families lost their loved ones. And today we have a millennial group that is virtual signaling, wearing their masks and patting each other on the back, you know that they got their vaccines. And to me, somehow the rebelliousness of the youth has seemed to evaporate into this, and it's the rebelliousness has reformed into virtual signaling, which is, to me, it's disgusting and really serves no purpose. It's kind of a it's a concentric spiral going nowhere.
And the sooner, and this with this I'll close because I have to go. But the fact is there is a I would say an unhealthy and extremely harmful desire for social approval that exceeds the desire for liberty. Okay, so if human beings are not careful, then their desire for social approval will definitely exceed their desire for liberty. Liberty is also altruistic. It is my liberty, but my liberty also means your liberty. So remember too that if you don't speak up now, if you don't fight this tyranny now, they'll come after you. You may not think so now, but I hope my words don't become prophetic. But if you don't fight this, you will be next.
Yes. And before I let you go, I would like to press you on the vaccine passport mandates that are coming to bear. And certainly, what we're seeing in France is particularly worrisome. And what are your thoughts on the situation in light of your historical knowledge of these other totalitarian regimes?
Remember, Michael, that dividing society is a very good rule from the playbook of the totalitarians. Okay, dividing the vaccinated from the unvaccinated knows that they know that the rulers know they can control society better if with divisions. We should never ever allow that. We should never allow that because this is a fundamental. Your health status is your personal and completely private information. We should never divide society based on your health status. For example, we should never, do we say that somebody with a particular, let's say, a cold, which is transmissible, okay, cannot enter a cinema theater? I mean, COVID is much more than a cold, of course. But we don't say if you have a fever, you can't come in. We do it voluntarily, of course. And most human beings, if they're sick themselves, they're going to stay at home. But a vaccine passport is it goes against medical ethics. But remember that for example, in the Soviet Union. Let me give you an example because it's good to know these historical examples.
Absolutely.
Ch children were the easiest targets for propaganda because they all had to go to state-run schools, and teachers would be fired if they were found to be religious. So it was the Soviet custom that if kids went to church on Sunday or to a mosque or to a synagogue. They would be mocked by their believing peers, believing that is in the Soviet tyranny. So most kids were essentially brainwashed into thinking that the Soviet system was the best, and they would then mock those kids who were not in that in official narrative, and that's happening now. There are kids shaming other kids to go and get vaccinated.
Yes,
And
absolutely.
children were the easiest targets for propaganda then, and they're still the easiest targets for propaganda because in the Soviet Union, all children were taught to have a higher loyalty to the state or to Pfizer or, in this case, the vaccine authorities than to their families. And they were encouraged to denounce their parents for anti-Soviet activities like attending church. So, tellingly and disturbingly, Not so long ago, there was a headline in one of the major newspapers. I think it was one of the Washington-based newspapers. It said, "Why children should disobey their parents and get vaccinated," or something to that effect. So this is what they're doing. They're dividing society, vaccinated, unvaccinated, you know, and society should push back with all its might.
And then, so what form should Canadians or citizens of the world, what must they do more or less immediately for people to maintain their freedom and liberty in the way that we enjoyed in 2018 or 2019? What are measures or steps that people can take?
Well, you know, I don't have a political playbook available, but I do know that if sufficient people inform themselves, get informed, and peacefully and within the law resist these tyrannical measures, you know, it'll have to be it'll ha the people will have to speak up for themselves. The public must rise and push back.
Yeah, very good. Well, sir, if you've got to run, let's wrap it up for today. It's been a pleasure to speak with you, and I thank you for being a brave and courageous physician at the front line and pushing back against this medical tyranny. God bless you and your family, and I hope to connect with you again in the future with perhaps some more positive news.
Thank you. God bless you, Michael. Take care.
Thank you, sir. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.